Welcome to the second hour of Echolocation, the Winter 2018 broadcast, Natural Radio. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lo Judas, and we began the first hour of this show listening to Douglas Quinn's underwater recordings of Weddell seals in Antarctica, which sound like this. Well, believe it or not, right now we're listening to the same species of seal on land. This isn't a chorus of drunk Homer Simpsons. It's the vocalization of mothers and baby Weddell seals. In the first hour, we listened to space weather and tunneled into the Earth in search of echolocators. This hour, we'll head down under to the southern hemisphere, exploring the Aurora Australis from Antarctica, as interpreted by sound artist Philip Samardzis. We'll talk to Philip about his work, listen to a few of his compositions, and hear more of Douglas Quinn's Antarctic recordings. You're listening to Echolocation, the Winter 2018 broadcast, Natural Radio. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lo Judas, and we've been listening to the recording of Weddell seal mothers and pups from Antarctica, recorded by sound artist Douglas Quinn and featured on his CD, which is entitled Antarctica. And we're going to turn now to another artist who has worked in Antarctica, Philip Samardzis, who is a sound artist and professor at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology in Australia. And Dr. Samardzis has recorded the natural and built soundscapes in areas around the world, including Australia, France, Germany, and Japan, and he's exhibited his work internationally. Additionally, Philip is the co-founder with Madeline Cornish of the Bogong Center for Sound Culture, which is located in the Australian Alps in Victoria. And I recorded this interview with Philip on December 20th, 2018, and the entire interview is nearly an hour long. So we're just going to play some excerpts for the show today. But if you'd like to hear the entire interview, I'll post a link on the Echolocation Facebook page at echolocation/WGXC@facebook.com. It turns out that Philip has been interested in recording and sound quality since he was a child in the 1960s. And his interest in sound engineering led him to become involved with experimental sound. And in the mid-90s, he shifted his audio practice from the studio to the field as technology evolved to support mobile recording. And he talks here about what philosophy and practice informs his field recordings.
There's something, from my perspective, disingenuous or disconnected to doing a bunch of field work somewhere, whether it's the Australian Outback or in the Swiss Alps, for instance, and then bringing it back to the studio and working in isolation or in a dislocated way from the source material. So I really wanted to respond directly to the conditions I encountered, and as a composer, let the environment speak for itself, and therefore there's obviously the soundscape movement that kind of thinks in those philosophical terms, trying to be as transparent as possible through my techniques and through my subject matter. And I guess that's the origins of where I began and continue to operate.
As a media arts student and sound designer, Philip conducted field recordings in France, Denmark, and Japan, all places that culturally informed his practice.
I was going to places primarily where English wasn't the first language, and I thought that was important because I just wanted to hear the environment as a musical composition in all its shapes and forms and characteristics, and therefore language is a big part of that. So spending time in remote communities in France, for instance, where there are very, very few English speakers and I don't speak French, meant that I was isolated and slightly disconnected from the community, and that gave me an opportunity to observe and to record and treat all material equally. And again, that's an important part of my practice, where I don't try and privilege my own agenda or my own kind of aesthetic sensibility over the material I'm encountering. So in that instance, the sound of a Renault to me is as interesting as an Alpine cow or something like that. So all those sounds are really fascinating, and they're all markers of a place. So that's also important.
Philip has also conducted extensive field recordings in Australia. And in recent years, he took his open mind and open ears to Antarctica as the recipient of two Australian Antarctic Division Arts Fellowships, one in 2010 and again in 2016. The fellowship supported 2 6-week-long trips to Davis Station, a remote Antarctic outpost, and the artwork that Philip produced during the fellowships documents the effects of extreme climate and weather events in eastern Antarctica and Macquarie Island. And we'll jump into the interview as the conversation turns to his work in Antarctica.
I read that music and literature were both inspirations for you in your interest in Antarctica, as well as the journals of explorers and the work of other sound artists. Can you describe how those things inspired you to apply for the fellowships originally?
Yeah, I guess we all have a fascination with the poles, both the Arctic and Antarctica. And I've just been fascinated by this place that's extremely inaccessible to most of us, those who aren't aligned with all the polar programs that each country tends to have. And eventually I started to think very, very deeply and seriously about a project that somehow demonstrated or represented what life on a remote research station is like. And so my original proposition was to document the stations in Antarctica as a way of understanding the protocols, the systems, the technologies required to sustain our presence down there and their immediate effects on the environment themselves. And the great irony, as I've pointed out many times, is that the very environment that we're trying to preserve, we're actually contaminating by having our stations there and all the waste and all the refuse that's that accumulates because of the human operations and activities there. And so I guess I'm not an adventurer in that sense. So people might disagree, but in fact, I'm very much comfortable in an urban context. So I was out of my comfort zone, but it also extended my idea of going out into the field. I wanted to take the technology and whilst I'd built a body of work around my techniques and ideas of field recording and sound art and so forth, I didn't want complacency to set in which I just repeated the kinds of same ideas but maybe in different locations or different communities. I wanted a really deep challenge, and therefore I was trying to think where's the most inhospitable place. So Antarctica clearly was on my mind, kind of documenting this arcane, rarefied environment that's the domain of highly specialized people was also really on my mind. And at that time, when I prepared my application, 2009, there wasn't a lot of information about Antarctica outside of natural history documentaries and things of that nature. And so just trying to understand what life was like on those stations wasn't as evident as it is now. And particularly when Werner Herzog's film Encounters at the End of the World came out, that by and large encapsulated a lot of things that I was trying to do with the Australian Antarctic program as well. So just to summarise, a lot of the interest that emerged around Antarctica was from a lot of science fiction and horror literature that I had read as a teenager or as a younger person. H.P. Lovecraft comes to mind, Campbell's The Thing as well, which is much quoted. And one of the interesting things about the Australian Antarctic Division's program is that as part of the indoctrination on station, you have to watch John Carpenter's version of The Thing from 1982, which I'm a great fan of. But for those who aren't so used to horror, body horror and gore, it really is a nice introduction to what life can be like on an Antarctic research station.
So then, I mean, one of the things that strikes me about your work is that you're documenting the interaction of the inorganic sounds of nature with the station itself, as well as the human presence on the stations. So, for example, you document the sound of wind on some of the human-built environment. Was that your concept from the get-go, or was that something that developed as you were on your trip?
Yeah, it really developed as the trip progressed. I had no real clear idea of what to expect, and until you get to a place like that. It is like traveling to Mars. You just don't know what you're going to encounter. So people try and kind of give you a sense of it. But in fact, most of the people I spoke to are kind of don't think about sound. And therefore they weren't very sonically literate. So they had lots of vivid impressions of the landscape as this pristine natural wilderness environment, and that's all good and well. And a few people would tell me a little bit about life on station, the helicopter services and the haglands and things of that nature. So, and I travelled by icebreaker the first time as well. So it was all new material, and I just wanted to ensure that it had the right technology and the right approach to recording to capture as much of the experience as possible. And probably the choice that I made was not to interview people. I really wanted the sounds of Antarctica to speak for themselves, as I mentioned earlier on. Let the environment do the talking. I don't necessarily need to rely on people's impressions or experiences so much. And that just allows the listener who ultimately hears the work that I'm producing to create their own associations and connections to what they think they're hearing. And for me, that's incredibly important. I don't want to be prescriptive in what I'm presenting, and therefore it is a snapshot of Antarctica, the infrastructure, the natural wilderness, the environmental conditions that often occur there. It is eastern Antarctica, so it's a more remote part of the continent, and it's the Australian program that I'm looking at as well, which has systems and protocols that are a bit different to others, other programs within Antarctica themselves, and therefore it's both specific and I think universal, and again I think that's important.
And as a result of, I think maybe both trips, you compiled your experiences in a book and. That includes two CDs called Antarctica and Absent Presence, which I find to be a really great format. It's both travelogue and vivid photographs and the audio pieces. Can you explain the concept behind the title of the book, An Absent Presence?
Yeah. Well, a good title for a book is a job in itself, let me tell you. It took me ages to you know, there's lots of white noise and I don't know, icebreaker, and there's lots of, you know, play on words around Antarctica, so it's really, really tricky thing. And and I had no the book captures my first trip to Antarctica in 2010, and I had no plan to produce a book, but and so the material that I prepared, the photographs in particular, were just what I call process photographs. They were just to document the microphone setups and the environments that I was recording at any given time, just to help jog my memory as I worked through the compositions to kind of connect what I was listening to a place. And particularly as I wasn't able to compose so much in Antarctica, the bulk of the work that I did was back in Melbourne, in fact. So the photos, I'm no photographer, let me tell you. So the photos were just done as quickly on a video camera, in fact, not even a camera, to jog my memory. And the editor at Thames and Hudson was really intrigued by what I was focusing on, because I wasn't necessarily looking at the icebergs and the glaciers that are surrounding at Davis Station, where I was located. They were kind of looking at fuel drums and kind of electrical cabling and very somber, lugubrious, dilapidated old huts and things, which I absolutely love. It's part of my interest in the abject. And so I was just focusing on details of Antarctica that no one really looks at or represents. I think Ann Noble in a fantastic New Zealand photographer has focused on some of those things at McMurdo Station, the US station, particularly trucks and the kind of emblems that the trucks have down there. So, I mean, there is a small community practice looking at these things, but I did them completely intuitively. And then I wrote the book about 3 or 4 years after I returned to Australia, and it was very much a memory of my trip there. So what I like about it is that in part it's fictional and in part it's fact. It's not that I was keeping a journal. I don't actually keep journals when I'm doing field work. I'm too focused on other things, and therefore I kind of looked at the photos and listened to the sounds and wrote this journal based on my memory of the trip. And I like this play of remembering from my memory of it. I think it's kind of quite true and accurate, but I like the idea of slippage, where maybe some of the things that I've remembered in fact didn't actually happen, and that to me is quite delightful.
I guess, just as an aside, really, I mean, that's one of the things that I find so intriguing about the photos, is we tend to think of the Arctic and the Antarctic as untouched places. And, you know, in reality, humans have not left any part of this planet untouched, mostly, and were a part of the ecology of our environment. And that's so evident in these photos, and also in the compositions that you've created, that humans are interacting with the natural environment in ways that create new sonic experiences as well as impacts on the natural environment.
Yeah, it's a great space to focus on that interaction between all those elements, and it certainly is a focus of mine. And it goes back, as I said, earlier on in the interview. It's in part homage to some of the references and influences that have underpinned my art practice. And I quote the futurists in some of the essays that I've written subsequently as an important source. And you know, when anyone talks about sound art, yeah, it kind of begins often with the futurists and Luigi Russolo's embracement of the noise of the city and thinking of urban sound and manufactured sound and industrial sound as musical elements. And clearly that's one of the narrative threads that informed 20th and 21st century music subsequently. So I take that notion very seriously, and I think of the Antarctic environment as a wonderful pristine wilderness full of Weddell seals and emperor penguins and skuas and all that and all the play of ice that's clearly in evidence there. But it's the sound of those haglands and helicopters and people, you know, going about their daily routines and the boisterous socializing that often happens on a station is the fabric of the Antarctic experience. And the only way we can really encounter that the continent is through the aperture of these remote research stations. And therefore, it's very hard to imagine that environment without the human presence and all the infrastructure and technology that's necessary to maintain the presence there.
Yes, and the presence of humans and the research apparatus allowed you to make some recordings that I'd like to focus on now. The show is, as I mentioned earlier, is featuring the polar lights, and I'm featuring some recordings by Steve McGreevy, who actually has been recording sounds of the northern lights in particular, but I'm also going to play a work of yours called Aurora Australis, and this renders a different perspective on the lights through sonification of data. Can you describe how that work came about and what it is?
Oh, sure, and I'm a big fan of Stephen McGreevy's, so he's the original influence in making me think about the activity in the upper atmosphere, in fact, and he's been a great influence on a lot of sound artists because he made his technology available, and you can buy his receiver from eBay currently. Cool. So anyone interested in both the Aurora Borealis and the Aurora Australis, then You can kind of get one of Stephen's units and tune in. But I was in Antarctica, and one of the great things there is the people that you meet and the science that's going on, much of it above my head. And so, you know, you get an opportunity to ask lots of questions around what are you looking at exactly? What are you researching? What does this tool do, or this technology, or this radar system? And one of the radar systems down at it's on all the Australian stations in Antarctica, is used to measure upper atmospheric solar winds and essentially the photons that are emitted in the upper atmosphere are charged by those solar winds, and they become fluorescent, if you will, and become these billowing clouds of fluorescent light or phosphorescent light that hangs over the station, particularly notable during the change of season. So I was there for a period of the summer, and then it quickly transitioned into the winter. And the auroras, as the nights became longer, when I first arrived, it was 22 hours of daylight. By the time I left, it was about 8 hours of daylight. So within the 6 weeks, we lost a substantial amount of light. The auroras started to appear, and whilst fascinating and lovely to look at, I was just wondering, do they make a sound? And Roland Steele, one of the engineers responsible for the radar systems, basically maintaining it, said that he could sonify it for me. And so he created a little software program that took the infrasound or the infrasonic recordings that they were making, which are well below the threshold of human hearing. I think they operate around about 2 hertz. And he was able to transpose the data into the human audible range. But what that essentially meant was that 24 hours of auroral activity ended up being crunched into a 4-second soundbite, which is relatively brief. But what he did was capture a whole year of aurora activity, and so I was able to put together, compose, but essentially just put together all these bytes that the software decoded from the data set, and turn it into about a 26-minute composition. And it really is a very dramatic rendering of the aurora, because whilst it looks beautiful and it shimmers and has this lovely kind of light fog presence, the sound of it is extremely dramatic. And you get a hint of that through Stephen McGreevy's recordings as well, this kind of electrical discharge that you can hear through his receivers. But this is much more fulsome because the technology is, you know, far more sensitive and far more sophisticated than the radio transmitters of Stevens. So it's fulsome, it's got a lot of subsonic activity, and it swirls around. And just to conclude, Roland was kind enough to also pull the data from Mawson Station, which is about 640 kilometres from Davis. Basically, Davis is, if you run your finger down from the tip of India down to Antarctica, that's what Davis is. And Mawson, if you run the tip from your tip of your finger from South Africa down to Antarctica, that's where Mawson is. And so he got that data as well. And so we were able to triangulate the two sets of data to create to render geospatial information. So you get this swirling kind of quality, because both stations are recording the same phenomena from different perspectives. So that created a very, very interesting experience as well.
You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM and wavefarm.org. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lojudis, and we've been listening to an interview with Australian sound artist Philip Samartsis. We're going to take a pause in the interview now and listen to his composition entitled Aurora Australis, which is the work that he's been describing in the interview.
Thank you.
You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM. We've been listening to the composition Aurora Australis, which is sound artist Philip Samartzis' rendering of the sounds of the southern lights as heard in Antarctica by a radar array and the data sonified for folks to be able to hear the sounds of the southern lights. And we're going to jump back into my interview with Philip now to talk about some other compositions that resulted from the time that he spent at Davis Station as an Australian Antarctic Fellow in 2010 and 2016.
Another piece that I really enjoyed a lot is called At the End of the Night. And can you describe this work and talk about how it highlights both human-made and atmospheric sound phenomena?
Yeah, the piece is based on a different radar system called the Medium Frequency Spaced Array radar system, which is looking at upper atmospheric solar winds, particularly kind of looking at things like aerosols and heating and cooling, things along those lines. And I was kind of working in the vicinity, and I could hear the sound of the transmission that sends a coded sine tone up into the atmosphere. It's a 54 second signal that it gets emitted every minute, so it's 54 seconds of sound, 6 seconds of silence, and then a different pitched sine tone is transmitted. And so what they're doing is measuring the distortion that occurs on the receiving signal as it bounces back to Earth, and that in some way they can gauge the velocity of the upper atmospheric winds through the distortions. So as a sound artist, you know, hearing those sine tones going, being pulsed up into space, you know, fascinating. And I made recordings of the transmissions, but then I also could just hear that the radar system itself was emitting a resonance sound, and that was being activated through the drop in temperature. At this stage, the general temperature on station was about -20, -25, and there was just a little bit of wind, not a lot, but just a little bit of wind. And so the radar system comprises 9 towers that are all interconnected, and they have all cables running off of them. So I attached an accelerometer, which is essentially an industrial-style contact microphone, onto the superstructure. I could hear these amazing beatings and resonances occurring between all the interconnected towers, and this kind of pulsing sine tone signal being sent and received into space. And I thought it really, for me, it was evocative and really, really an exciting kind of phenomenon to capture, because in some ways it represents to me the kind of the alien environment that Antarctica is, the volatility that's occurring in the upper atmosphere, and the effects of cold on superstructure as well. And so what you're hearing are a number of different things, but I kind of gave it a poetic title, because it could be a piece of drone music generated by potentially synthesizers or different kinds of acoustic instruments. It's very familiar, whilst also being quite alien at the same time. The title is a play on Celine's Journey at the End of the Night, which is one of my favourite books. So I just thought that I would shorten the title and convey something that is occurring in the margins of our planet, but also connecting terrestrial with extraterrestrial or otherworldly sound.
You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM and wavefarm.org. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lowe-Judas, and on this second hour of our Echolocation Winter 2018 broadcast, we're talking with sound artist Philip Samartzis about his work in Antarctica. We're going to pause here and take a listen to At the End of the Night, which is the composition that Philip has been describing in the interview. This entire composition is over 20 minutes long, so we don't have time to listen to all of it this evening. So we'll listen to an excerpt. But if you like what you hear and you're interested in hearing more of it, you can purchase Philip's book, Antarctica, An Absent Presence, by visiting bookdepository.com. We've been listening to a field recording from Antarctica by sound artist Philip Zimartsis called At the End of the Night. We've just listened to an excerpt from the piece, and if you're interested in hearing more, you can visit bookdepository.com and search for Philip's book, which accompanies two CDs. The name of the book is Antarctica and Absent Presence. Or you can visit Philip's SoundCloud page, and that can be found if you search at SoundCloud, Philip Zimartsis, Antarctica and Absent Presence. There's an hour-long recording. You can also visit the Bogong Center for Sound Culture's website at bogongsound.com.au, and that's bogongsound.com.au, to learn more about Philip's work.
Well, everyone wants to know what it's like in Antarctica. So, you know, I field many, many inquiries, lots of emails, lots of phone calls, people wanting to go down there and things like that. So a lot of the work that I do is like trying to share the experience, because something that might be interesting to you and your listeners is that a lot of the arts programs that I've obviously been a beneficiary of are actually contracting, not expanding. So the Argentine program has just ceased. The British Antarctic Survey stopped their program. New Zealand's essentially reorientated theirs to just really be a kind of an outlet for media. So people working within the arts, whether it's sound art or fine art, photographers, video artists, that kind of thing, access to the continent is becoming less and less available. Clearly, the National Science Foundation of the States offers an opportunity as well. So with this limited access to the continent, it kind of becomes, you know, I feel a responsibility in some way as an advocate to create projects that not necessarily are self-serving, but more kind of allow people to just experience some of those conditions, some of those protocols, to kind of, I guess, expand their understanding and notion of what Antarctica is. So I think that's been the great success of this project is providing an experience of Antarctica through the aperture of a research station rather than just playing lovely recordings of, Doug Quinn's Weddell seals are, you know, unbeatable. So what can I offer as an artist that's a bit different to some of the great work that's been done by Doug and Chris Watson and others?
And that creates a perfect segue to one of my last questions. You mentioned Doug Quinn, who is from our neck of the woods here in the Hudson Valley. He works at Syracuse University and is a sound artist who, as you mentioned, has also recorded in the Antarctic. And you are going to be co-hosting a master class on field recording with him in the summer of 2019, I guess summer here of 2019. Can you describe that class?
Sure. One of the things that I do is I'm the co-director of the Bogong Center for Sound Culture, which I established with Madeline Cornish to document the effects of climate change on the Australian Alps, which are kind of small in comparison to other Alps, but incredibly important because they provide 80% of our fresh water in Australia. So they only comprise 2% of the landmass. So it's a small but very, very important part of the country. And so the Bogong Centre for Sound Culture essentially does lots of different projects, art projects, festivals, and masterclasses from time to time for people wanting to engage with the environment through sound predominantly. And we thought it would be fun to maybe do something in winter. We're in the Alps, so we do get a fair amount of snowfall in the winter season, which for us begins start of June and kind of runs to about the end of September into October. And therefore, both Doug and I thought it'd be fun to do maybe a masterclass in the snow, which and present students or participants with the same, similar challenges than to the ones that you encounter in cold environments, not necessarily just the polar regions. Clearly, North America has some challenging environments as well. So, but yeah, it's very unusual, again, for an Australian artist or people from our region, Asia-Pacific region, to encounter those conditions. So it's an opportunity to kind of imagine what fieldwork in Antarctica or in some of the alpine regions across the world is like, how to prepare for it, what kind of technology is useful in those environments, how to dress for it. It's in some ways it's a challenge because you really have to hunt out sound, and so it's not evident or as explicit as what it is during the summertime, and therefore what are we trying to do exactly, what kind of outcomes are we trying to produce, how to be creative in the field when nothing's going right, and there isn't that sound that you're after. So there's lots of really interesting conversations, and Doug is a leader in the field. He's a wonderful composer and sound artist, done significant work in Antarctica. So I'm looking forward to spending time with him and learning from his experiences and through his practice. And he brings a completely, I think, different sensibility and different level of expertise to what I do. But together, I think we'll cover some really interesting territory.
If you're interested in learning more about the masterclass, The Art of Field Recording with Philip and Douglas Quinn, you can visit the Bogong Sound website at bogongsound.com.au. And the masterclass will take place in July of 2019, so it'll be winter in the Australian Alps. I'd like to thank Philip Samartsis for his generosity of time and giving me this interview to share with you all. And we're going to let one more recording from Douglas Quinn take us out this evening. This is another recording from his CD entitled Antarctica, and this is the sound of wind harps from the Taylor Valley. Thanks for listening to Echolocation, and we'll see you in the spring.